Bill, I'm an alcoholic. And this is a big deal for me. I really want to thank John and everybody involved, and Milton and everybody involved in asking me to be here. It means it's the biggest thing that ever happened to me in AA. I got asked to talk at my sponsor's birthday. I think it was his 38th birthday. And prior to this, that was the biggest thing. I just hope that that I can tell you a little bit about what has happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I get so damn nervous that a lot of times it doesn't show through what's happened, for not to me, but for me. So I'm praying today that that doesn't happen. And there's a lot of people in this room that know my story as well as I do, I think. I sponsor some of the people in this room, some of the people involved in this roundup. And they, I don't know why they keep calling me, but they do, and it's the most wonderful thing for me. I really was looking forward to this since the minute that John asked me, because I was at Mount Eagle a year ago, and I really enjoyed it. When I first walked in, everybody that I knew here was so involved, I thought they were going to make a big deal of me being here, and they did, but it wasn't big enough for me, see? And I like it when people pay a lot of attention to me, and they're all pretty busy. But I've been hearing for years about this, and from a lot of people, and so about the first 15 minutes I was here, I said, well, they lied to me. It ain't that big a deal. But as the longer I stayed, the more I felt the love that's here. And I want you all to give yourself a hand. If your purpose was to make people feel welcome, you have done a wonderful job. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. I felt real good about this until Grace started her talk on Friday night. And I thought to myself, oh, this is going to be tough, Bill. This is going to be tough. But I was all right. And then I got up Saturday morning, heard Bob, and I after that I thought, oh Lord, I feel so sorry for Al. He has to follow, and I did. I'm telling you. And then Al did what he did. He showed me how to follow Bob, and did such a wonderful job. And I thought to myself, Bill, you know, this is the best speakers I've ever had, that I've ever heard, and 3 out of 4 ain't bad. You know what I mean? I woke up about the first time about 3 o'clock this morning. And I've been telling this story since 3, so I hope it might sound a little erratic. For the last several years, I've been involved in big book studies with men. There have been, 4 different ones, I think, right there. And we're involved in one now. And as a part of the big book, you're supposed to write an inventory. And I've been a little, I've delayed it a little bit. And I thought, what a neat deal. When John asked me to do that, I said, well, that'll give you an inspiration to finish your 4-step. Now, this is not my first 4-step, and it's not my second. I've written a lot of inventory since I've been sober. And they've changed a lot since I started. But anyway, so I thought, well, how the road to hell is paved with good intentions, I was going to have that inventory finished and shared, and I'd be all settled down and ready to rock and roll. I brought that inventory up with me in the car Friday when Terry and I rode up here, and I said, I'm going to finish it before I talk. So yesterday afternoon, after we heard that beautiful music, I got up yesterday morning and wrote and finished the inventory. And we came back from listening to the bluegrass music. I came to this chapel and sat over here and was sharing it. Milton caught me. I didn't get to share it with a sponsor, but I was trying to share it with God. That switched a little bit since my first one, because I was really scared about sharing it with my sponsor the first time. And I didn't think about the God part near as much as I do today. And that's a big difference for me. But anyway, I did get that done, but it really didn't settle it down, because I woke up 3 o'clock this morning starting. So I'm going to start one more time and see if I can get it right. I did say my name's Bill, I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to know that. That answered a lot of questions in my mind. I got sober when I was 37. My sobriety date is April the 15th of 1980. When I finally figured out that I was an alcoholic, like I say, it answered a lot of my questions, because I did not know what was wrong with me. And some of the things I've learned in here explained a lot of the things, to almost everything to me, that all the questions I had when I was growing up. My father is deceased now. He was a physician and a very, very good doctor and loved by the community. And my mother was my father's wife. She was a person under herself. I found out after he died, she kind of blossomed. But all the time, she seemed to me like to be the mother of the kids and the husband of the doctor. And dad ruled. I thought, after writing a lot of inventories, I figured out who was really calling the shots. But it took me a while to figure that out in here. But when we talk in the first step about having an unmanageable life, I define that today as doing things I don't want to do and not doing the things I want to do. When I was growing up, I loved my father, but you'd have never known it, except if I wanted something. He was a very smart man with everybody else in this world except me. And I had it figured out how I could con him. So we fought all the time. I'll give you an example. And he tried. He really tried. I give you an example of our relationship. He said, one time, he said, I was just starting high school, and he said, I get 2 weeks of vacation a year. We're going up to Michigan on this 1 week of vacation. I'd love to take you, and I will take you if you can guarantee me that we won't fight. And I said, well, there's no way that I can guarantee that, because I don't start them. And I believed that. I don't anymore believe that, but I believed that at the time. And I thought, what a stupid thing to say. He was a wonderful provider, and we had everything you need. In fact, I had no idea when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous what it meant by depending on a power greater than yourself. Because I just asked Dad. If I really wanted something, I'd ask him if he didn't If he didn't give it to me, then I'd keep asking and keep asking until I drove him crazy until I got it. So I didn't, and that's as deep as I was. This is not real spiritual kid when I, you know. The only thing I knew about church was, is that I had to go with my grandmother, who was my father's mother, and I didn't like her. And that was a justified resentment. It's not really, but I thought for years it was. And but that's all I identified church with. I didn't feel anything about it except I didn't want to be there. And then when I got old enough to go in a car, you know, that was a good place to say you were going. We never went, but, you know, we got dressed up like we were going, but, you know, but anything to get the car. But anyway, so my father was a wonderful physician, and he was a very good provider and treated me very well, if I'd let him. But he said something to me one night when I was about 15 or 16 years old that absolutely has changed my whole life. We were fighting about applying for college, and I really didn't want to go to college, and because I didn't think I was ready. I was not a good student. I'm smart enough to be a good student, but I wasn't a good student. And he said to me, in a fit of anger, he said, "Bill, your only problem is that you can't make yourself do what you need to do when you need to do it." And that shot through me like a gun. Because he had described to me the feelings that I had about myself my whole life. You know, I couldn't figure out. I didn't want to be the kid that was in detention or on the dismissed list or the expelled list from school. I wanted to be the guy that was getting good grades and that was well liked, you know, and admired. But I couldn't make myself study. I couldn't make myself do those things you need to do to achieve those things because I had so much other things to do. You know, I love to play. If you're not in school, you need to be playing. After a while, I figured out if you're in school, you need to be playing. You know, and it was just like a game. And I was liked in my high school, but not respected because nobody could figure out what I was going to do. I know why, because I didn't know what I was going to do. You know, the football coach was also a health teacher, and I didn't play football. I used to say because I wasn't allowed to. My dad, that isn't true. I'm a big chicken. But he was kind of a smart aleck, and he walked into junior health class, and he said, "Does anybody in here need paddling?" And I'll be damned if I didn't raise my hand. And it shot up there, and I'm going, "What are you doing?" You know, and he just whacked me. And next day, asked the same question, and there it goes again. And this time, he made me stand in the corner. This is degrading. This is. I stand in the corner in the wastebasket with my nose in a circle on the chalkboard. That doesn't look good, you know, but here I am. He said, "You do that again, it's going to be worse." He never asked again. And I'm afraid my hand would have shot up if he would have. But see, that's not the kind of guy I wanted to be. And I wasn't fitting in. I wasn't fitting into anything. I was fitting in, but I wasn't in my own mind. I didn't feel a part of anything. I didn't run with people in my own high school. I ran with people in another high school. And I found out later it's because I didn't want anybody to get real close to me. because I didn't like what was in here. And if you get close, you might find out, and then I really would be in trouble. The only thing that I did that made me fit in was drink. And I learned that I ran with some people that knew how to do that. And I started early. I fell off a bar stool when I was 13. I looked older when I was 13 than I did when I was 23. I don't know why that was, but I never had got asked for ID until after I was of age. But I was running with some guys that were older than me, and they were also too young to drink what we were drinking. And we went to this place over by my father's office. That surprises me. It's right next door to my dad's doctor's office. And it's called the Wedgwood Inn. And we're in there one night drinking Boilermakers. And I drank three of them on the stool and three of them on the ground. You know? And I'm afraid of falling off the stool again, you know? And that was my first outside-the-house deal with alcohol. I got brought home when I was 15 years old, and this is going to tell you a little bit about my mother. It's funny, but it's not funny. When my dad was out of town, when I was 15 years old, and they had left some beer in the refrigerator, and Mom was playing golf, and I drank 2 6-packs of beer and got on the bus and went downtown Dayton, okay? They brought me back at police car that evening and brought me up to the door. Of course, my mother's horrified. She didn't know where I was, and she said, "What's going on?" And they said, "Well, Ms. Freeze, we have a question. We want to know how old he is." And said, "Well, he's why?" He said, "Well, he's got 2 driver's licenses in his pocket. One says he's 21, the other one says he's 18. And I was 15. And she said, "Well, he's 15. And she said, "What's he doing with these driver's licenses to say that he's the other age?" And she said, "They're misprints." And you know what? You don't get driver's license till you're 16, see? And you know what? She believed that. She believed that. I remember when she told me something when I was growing up. She said, "Bill, you can't lie to yourself." And I thought she meant, you can't lie to yourself. Not, you better not lie to yourself. And when you think about it, how do you lie to yourself? You know, you're right here. Yeah. You know? I struggled with that for a long time. So I went overseas and was gone a year. I went to Vietnam. And when I got back, I was feisty. And I said, "Mom, how's come you didn't write me when I was over in Vietnam?" And she said, "Billy, I'm sorry, but I couldn't address the envelope. That would have meant I was there." And that's the lady that told me that I better not lie to myself. Now, I'm not knocking them, because I love them dearly. They're both deceased. And I know with all my heart that they did the best job they could. But, and I loved them then, and I didn't act like it. But you know, I've learned a lot about this thing since I've gotten sober. But alcohol played a big part in my life, because I was doing things that were not acceptable to me. And the only way that I could do it is to drink. And then I could blame it on the fact that I was drunk. And I flunked out of school. I went to Miami University and flunked out the first time, got thrown out the second time, and went back and went to a little school in Dayton, Ohio, and did pretty well, and then went off. I had to go off and go to the service. A lot of the reasons for my failures in school were because of alcohol and the fact that I couldn't make myself do what I needed to do when I needed to do it. Now, I thought about that every day. There's not a day since I was 16 years old that I haven't thought about that. I still do today because it's my dilemma. Lack of power is my dilemma. When I read that in a big book, that hit me like a ton of bricks. Because that's absolutely the truth. Nothing is truer than that. But anyway, I went in the Air Force, and I got married in the Air Force, and had two wonderful sons while I was in the Air Force. Got out, and we moved back to Dayton. I finished an associate degree and went to work at a very, very good company up in Toledo, Ohio, and we were drinking a lot, and my first wife drank a lot too, not near what I did, but she tried to keep up. And then we moved on a promotion to go to Detroit. And if there's a, you know, they talk about that line that you cross, that invisible line. If I crossed one, it was right then, because we were going to build a house, and my wife had moved back to another city where her parents lived, and I was staying with her brother and sister in Toledo, Ohio, while our house was being built. And I went out one night and got drunker than I'd ever gotten in my life. And I was staying in their basement. And I got drunk on Friday night. And they had an old house that had a big old basement in it. And they were home. I got home early Saturday morning. And they were home all weekend, and I was down in the basement, and I couldn't move, and they thought I was gone. And I thought I was dying. And I never, ever had control over alcohol again. I mean, I really do believe I crossed that line that day, because I started to be unable to predict what was going to happen. But it didn't matter, because I loved being drunk. You know, I could do more things drunk than I could sober. I was a much better dancer. I was a better driver. But, you know, I wasn't so nervous on the road, as long as I didn't overshoot. But I was better salesman, you know, and I learned that early. And so drinking was fine with me as long as it was working, you know. So I really did pretty well. I advanced in that company and got up to Detroit and had a good job. And all of a sudden, and I was drinking just like you're supposed to, you know, and I was driving down the Lodge Freeway, which is a big highway in Detroit, going 85 miles an hour at 8 o'clock in the morning, with cars 4 inches in the front and the back and on each side of me. And I got horrified. And I said, I need a drink. I need a drink. And I couldn't. You know, you can't drink at 85 miles an hour. I didn't have any with me then. But that's when I started to see that I needed to fortify myself. And that's really when morning drinking started. I got out of there. I quit that job and moved south. And that's how I got down here. Moved to Hilton Head Island, South Carolina, where my parents were living. Got in a lot of trouble. Met some friends down there that were just like me, and we went out playing all the time. I was not a very nice guy. And my first wife finally had enough, and she said, "I'm leaving." We got divorced. We didn't get divorced then, but she decided she was going to leave Hilton Head, and she did. She moved all the way to Colorado Springs, Colorado. I mean, that's getting divorced now. and it appeared to me again that I was treating her in ways that I didn't want to treat her. I loved that woman. But I couldn't figure out what's wrong with me. I couldn't tell her that. I couldn't act that way. I just hated myself. And the only way that I could sustain that was to drink. Once she left, then the pressure kind of got off a little bit, and I settled down a little bit and started getting physically pretty active, and met another girl, married her, and we were divorced after 13 months, and she was okay too, and I wasn't. And when she left, she said, "You know, you really are a son of a bitch." And I thought, that's not what I want to be. So I left Hilton Head and moved to Atlanta and got a job with the very first company I started working for, the big one, the good one. And worked for them for a while, and at this time I was a daily drinker all the time. Drank all day, every day. One day, my boss was coming to town. I had about three or four bosses, but my big boss was coming from New York to Atlanta to travel with me to find out why my customers weren't buying stuff. Not why I wasn't selling it. And the reason that he wasn't coming to why I wasn't selling stuff is because I was telling him I was doing things I wasn't doing. See, I knew what to do. I just couldn't do it. You know, it's hard to sell stuff when you drive by and throw the catalog out the window. And I hate to say this, but I've done that a couple times. And Jim Williams was the original guy that said that in his talk one time, and I said, you know, I identify with that. But so he came down here, and I picked him up at the airport, and by this time I was a daily drinker, and it was getting close. And I knew that there was something wrong, but I didn't know what it was, and I didn't know it was alcohol, because alcohol is the only thing that's getting me through this mess. So I picked him up at the airport and drove him to a hotel right near my apartment, and told him I was going to pick him up the next day at 8 o'clock in the morning. So I went home and I went to bed, and my only question on the way home was, what time am I going to have to get up to get drunk enough to go? And so I decided at 5 would be good, and got up at 5, and I was fully dressed at 6 o'clock in my three-piece suit, sitting on my couch in my living room drinking vodka out of the bottle. And about a quarter of 8, I got the biggest fear, scare, absolute terror, feeling that it didn't work. I'm not going to be able to do this. And it was the scaredest I've ever been. Just a little bit more scared than I was when I got up here. No, but a terror gripped me that, you know, even alcohol's given up. And I did not know what to do. I was at the end. So I called him up and I said, I got a letter last night when I got home from dropping you off at the airport, and my checking account screwed up, and I need to stop by the bank on the way to getting you, so I'll be a little late. That wasn't a lie. My checking account was a little screwed up. I didn't get a letter, but... So I decided what I was going to do. I was already dressed, so I just got my half gallon, got my car, and I started to drive around, and when I got drunk enough, I'd get it, you know? So I started driving around. Circles got bigger and bigger. About 2:30 in the afternoon, I thought, you know, you might be in a little trouble. And I hadn't called him yet. You know, I called him once, that's enough. And uh, My finances are pretty screwed up. It might take me a while anyway, but and I said, you know, you're in big trouble here, and you need to do something big, because this is big. He's come all the way from New York to be with you, and you can't do it. And so I decided I'd be sick. And you got to be able to prove this. Now, if you're not from Atlanta, you won't understand this. But when I was having this thought, I was driving down Briarcliff Road, and I decided I was going to check into a hospital. And there's a hospital on Briarcliff Road in Atlanta, Georgia. It's called the Georgia Mental Health Institute. And so I went to go check in. And they wouldn't let me in. They said, what are you here for? I said, alcohol. They said, when do you have, what time did you have your last drink? And I said, well, what time is it? And they said, have you had a drink in the last 6 hours? And I said, well, heck yeah. And they said, we can't let you in here if you had a drink in the last 6 hours. And I said, if I could go 6 hours without a drink, I wouldn't be standing here. So I decided that I needed to go home and try it again tomorrow. And I don't know why I did this, but I took a taxi home and left my company car there. And I knew I was in trouble. And so I decided my weapon against real bad stuff was anger. And I thought, if I can get mad enough at these people, I can justify that. So I decided I hated them. And I packed up everything that I owned, that the company, that I had that the company owned, and put it in a box. And put it right by the door, because I knew they were coming. And I started drinking again. And sure enough, there came a knock on that door. I thought it was going to come off the hinges. And I opened the door, and it was my boss and his boss and his boss. And I said, thank you very much. I'm glad I worked for you for a while, but it's all over, and here's all my stuff, and I'll see you later. Shoved that box in the face, and they said, can we come in? And I said, yeah, I guess. Yeah. And they came in. I didn't want them in there. And they said, what's wrong? And I started to cry. I said, I don't know. I do not know. And they said, well, you're drunk. I've never seen you drunk. This is the guy that I love, that I work for. I said, Norm, you haven't seen me sober in 6 months. He said, I'd have never known. I said, well, I don't know what's wrong. He said, what do you want to do? I said, I have no idea. I have no idea. I said, I do know something about a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know a thing about Georgia Mental Health Institute. And I think I want to go there. And they said, you want to go to a mental institute? I said, it's a great idea. You know, and it was. Yeah. So they said, okay. And they said, I said, just take this stuff with you and forget I even exist. This is everything that I have that's the company's. So they said, there's one thing missing. And I said, what's that? And they said, the car. Where's the car? And I said, I don't know. I said, it's there. And They said, where? And I said, the Georgia Mental Health Institute. They said, well, where is that? And I said, I don't know. And I didn't know. I mean, I didn't drive to Briar Cliff Road because I knew that place was there. I just passed it and saw the sign. You know that? I had no idea where it was. And they started getting angry. They thought I was kidding, see? And they said, well, don't worry about it. So anyway, I took a cab to the Georgia Mental Health Institute the next day, drank before I got there, but I knew then you just didn't tell them. And that was the 15th day of April, 1980. I haven't had a drink since. I'll sit down right now. I thought my life was over. And if those of you who are in here with alcoholics, I don't have to explain that to you. And if you don't understand that, you never will anyway. You know? They did exactly what they're supposed to do. They drive me out, and they introduced me to AA. And they did something funny. When I left there, they said, you better go to AA. If you don't go to AA, we're going to tell your employer. I said, damn, I better go. I'm going to tell you something. The first miracle happened right there. I didn't lose that job. I'd like to be able to tell you the reason I didn't lose that job is because I was such a good employee. That's not true. 5 years before this, a guy had had the same problem that worked for that company. His name was Max. And he had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he had turned into a very, very, very good employee. And they were willing to give me the same chance. And I couldn't believe it. I did not deserve that. And when I got out of there and went to my first meeting was a little house, Clarkston. And I met a guy that was become my sponsor. His name's Jim. And I told him that story. And he said, you better never forget that. You cannot violate that trust. Because if you violate that trust, the next drunk might not get the same chance. That's a big deal. I didn't lose that job because I wasn't doing it. I lost that job because they quit the program that I was in, an experimental program. And I left with a letter of recommendation and went to work in a company that they supplied. It was the same line of work, just a jobber kind of thing. And I was so very glad that I didn't burn that bridge. But this relationship with this sponsor started, and I really was sick when I got here. I mean, I could read a sentence, and at the end of the sentence, I couldn't remember what the first word was. And my sponsor knew that. So he came over to my house about 3 weeks into the deal, and he said, I want to sit and talk to you about how I work the steps. He didn't tell me how I should work the steps. He told me how he worked. And he sat there for 5 hours explaining this whole thing to me because he wanted me to know what was ahead. And I was absolutely flabbergasted that this guy would spend 5 hours with me just for me. And so at the end when he was finished, I said, Jim, I can't tell you what this means to me, that you do this for me. He said, God, you got it wrong. I'm not doing this for you. If you get something out of that, just fine. I'm doing it for me. And he said, you'll never understand until it happens to you. You'll never understand until some poor sick drunk calls you on the phone and said, I need help. My son came to live with me when I was about 6 months sober, and I couldn't believe it. My oldest son, Hank, who I just dearly, I love my kids, love all five of them, but this was back when I only had two, and he came to live with me, and I called his mother. Hank didn't fall far from the tree. He doesn't drink, but he's an obstinate, you know. And he was driving his mom crazy. And she gave him an alternative. He either goes to a counselor or goes to live with his old man. And she called me up and told me that. And I said, will you please send him out here? And she said, yeah. I said, when's he coming? And she said, 2 weeks. And I said, okay. I called my sponsor up. And I said, Jim, you're not going to believe this. Hank's coming to live with me. When's he coming? 2 weeks. He said, what the hell is he waiting 2 weeks for? And I said, I don't know. Peggy said he had to collect his paper route. And Jim said, how much is it they owe him? I said, probably about $20. He said, Bill, call her back up and tell her to give her the $20 and send him tomorrow. If he's in trouble, you need him to come tomorrow. So on Father's Day at 5:30 in the morning, Hank arrived. Scared, 14 years old, doesn't know who I am, and I don't know who I am. And the first thing we did, got him off the plane, drove to Petrie Hospital, which is a recovery hospital, and had breakfast with two guys that just landed in there from going back out again. Jim and Hank and I and these two drunks sitting there having breakfast in a wacky ward. I bet his mother didn't think much of that. But on the way home, Jim says, what do you think of this thing, Hank? And he said, I can't believe how much you guys talk about loving each other. And I thought to myself, you know, this is bad. Hank lived with me for a while. He was worried about it. He got active in Alateen, and he was worried about his relationship with his mother. They taught him how to inventory, and he wrote an inventory on his relationship with his mother. At the end of the summer, we had a deal that he was going to decide. And she didn't want me to tell him that. But I thought, when he got there, and I thought, well, that'd be lying to him. So I told him, at the end of the summer, I want you to decide where you're going to live, either here with your mom. She doesn't know that you're going to know that, but that's the deal. So she called me on the phone and said, what did Hank decide? I said, I have not asked him. I don't know. I said, if you want to know that, you better ask him. So she said, we'll put him on the phone. And he kind of hemmed and hawed around a little bit. And he finally said, Mom, I'm going to stay here, but it's not for the reason you think. And she got madder than hell. Got me on the phone and accused me of a lot of things, like talking to him into it and all that stuff. And I hadn't. So I said, that's not true. And if you ever trusted me before, I want you to hear this. I want you to shut up about this deal and let him work it out. Because he's more worried about his relationship with you than you are. Let him work it out. And she said, okay. He went back to live with her, and that relationship was repaired. He's 35 now, so I mean, you know, a lot. But he learned that in Alateen, and he still talks about inventory today when he has a problem. Isn't that amazing? What a gift. I don't even know what time it is. Lord have mercy. There are so many things, that's just an example, so many things that have happened to me as a result of being sober. and trying to work this deal. Everybody has talked about their home group. My home group is the Lilburn Third Tradition Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet on Monday night and Saturday night. We have a step meeting, two step meetings, two how it works meetings, and a beginner's meeting, and a traditions meeting on Monday. It's a big group. Do big book study on Saturday night and how it works. So if you're ever in Atlanta, we'd love to have you come. But there's an awful lot of good AA in Atlanta, and I'm glad there is because I need all of it. The thing that's happening now, I never thought that I would ever be able to say, I've been here 21 years. When I first came in, my first home group was a second home group was a speakers meeting, and there was a couple of guys, Pat W. and Bill R., used to come in there, and they looked good, and they were both about 21 or 22 years sober then, and they acted like they were glad to see you, even if you had about 15 minutes. And I just loved them, you know, and they were full of what I wanted, you know. And that's why I think this year, this whole year coming up to my 21st birthday has been one of absolute reflection. I mean, looking back at what's happened and looking at how things are the way they are. And I would have liked to have been able to tell you that this inventory that I wrote wasn't as long as it was. But it's a long one. And Pat and I got married about 9 years ago, 8 years ago. We've known each other 9 years, it'll be 8 years, right, in July. 7 years in July. Oh, I've screwed that up. And I can't get out of that like I say, well, it seems like that long, that's worse. But so I'm going to drop it. But we have known each other 9 years. And we met through mutual friend of ours and people I dearly love. And we started running together, and I've been chasing her ever since. But we got to know each other, and we've run three marathons together, which I never dreamed of. My whole dream was to run a marathon before I was 50. And I met her just prior to the July 4th on the year of my 50th birthday. And we trained and ran the Marine Corps Marathon with Richard and Lindsay. And that was their, he's an Al-Anon, she's a bad drunk. And, no, I love her. She talked on my 20th, and I couldn't even, I loved every minute. But anyway, so we've been, Pat is my current wife, and she's also my fourth wife. And so I didn't get here knowing how to have relationships real well. I just couldn't get them to stay long enough to get them sick, you know. Anyway, so she's active in Al-Anon. I'm as active as I can be in AA because I need all of them. I really do. And on this inventory, I saw some things that I was surprised at. One of them is, when I first got sober, a man named Franklin Williams came to stay with me. And you talk about a gift. He was speaking at my second home group's first anniversary. And he stayed in my house for 5 days. And they used to call him the Pope. Didn't they call him the Pope? And he was one of the most wonderful men I've ever met. And my sponsor would run him all over town all during the day, and then I'd get him all night. And I kept him up. But Franklin said to me one time, I was talking to him about my home group, and he said, if you don't belong to the best home group, make it the best home group. Don't carry that disease somewhere else. And you know, if you think a little bit about that, you can apply that to an awful lot of things. And right now in my life, this is the only time that I, and I mean the only time, that I've ever wanted to keep a job or that I ever wanted to stay married. If you think about a drunk like me wanting to stay in something, it's a miracle, because the way my mind works, I'm out of here, baby. Whoop, you say one thing, I'm gone. Now, I'm not saying that my mind still doesn't work that way, because it does. But I don't pay attention to it near as much as I did anymore. But the thing that I saw in this inventory that amazed me is that the reason I brought up Franklin Williams, he talks a lot about surrender. And he talked about a big surrender, Red McGinnis surrender. And I saw in there that that's what I'm in. That's what this whole thing is about. Is just one big surrender after another. When my sponsor's name is John, and to put this 21 years in perspective, this is the last year that John will be able to say that he's twice as sober as me. Because he's celebrated 42 years. And that's where the rubber hits the road, baby. I have the greatest respect of time. The people that keep coming, we were talking about this. You guys with your time that keep coming, God, don't quit. Because we need you. We need you. We were talking about Jim this morning and what a wonderful example of Alcoholics Anonymous he is. What? You know what a deal. You know, these aren't people that are gods. These are real men and women with real feelings. Self-centered people that have come to know this power that keeps us together through working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I was nervous as the devil about this talk this morning. What do I have to say that you all want to hear? You know, I look at my life and I think, well, this is the craziest thing I've ever seen in my life. I'm having more fun than I ever thought I'd have. You know, I never thought it'd be like God. 21 years ago, I thought it was over, but it only just begun. But when I think about the people that went before, and when Bob talked about his father, Bill, you know, what a deal. And we almost missed it. You know, if that ain't God-inspired, the way that whole thing came together, it's the most amazing story I've ever heard. I am so grateful that you let me come up and share with you and just be with you. I have never felt love more than I felt. Thank you very much.